Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And on this Christmas holiday, we are joined by Sister Ann Kendrick, who is one of the co-founders of the Hope Community Center in Apopka, Florida. In 1971, Sister Ann and three other members of the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur moved to the area bordering Orlando and founded what was originally called the Office for Farm Worker Ministry. Since then, Sister Ann and her partners have been working to address the problems confronting migrant laborers in Central Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sister Ann Kendrick.
Happy to be a part of your program.
And on this Christmas holiday, what are you doing and what are the members of your community doing?
Well, a lot of the farm workers in this area are Mexican or Mexican-American, and they have a beautiful, beautiful Christmas tradition in the days leading up to Christmas. And so we've been every night in different communities during this lead-up to Christmas, celebrating Las Posadas, which is sort of a reenactment of Joseph and Mary on the road and seeking lodging and seeking a safe place as Mary prepares to deliver her child. And so since this is an immigrant community, a farm worker community, a poor immigrant community, and a good chunk of the community are undocumented and have in this last year or two particularly suffered, untold harassment and racial profiling simply for driving without a driver's license, because since September 11th they're unable to renew driver's licenses that they've had for 20 years or more. So it's and we don't exactly live in New York City where they can hop on the on the subway. So it's been a particularly rough year in terms of immigration. So our theme of this Posadas this year, and actually last year, has been the one of immigration and imagining that, those of us of this Christian tradition, we believe in a God that actually migrated. Our God was a migrant who migrated from the all-powerful throne of the great Creator to be born a humble and vulnerable child, in the very poorest of circumstances, to actually immigrant parents who are on the road, as so many of our people are, and who, at the moment of his birth became a refugee child and had to flee to Egypt, where I'm sure that there was not a border crossing guy looking for, his mika, his green card. Or visa. So it's to try to help the people see, that their migratory status and their struggle with all of this being a people on the move, is something that is very known to the God of our many understandings and with great incarnational knowledge, that their life is on the radar, and we care about that, and we hope and work for social justice so that their movement not be so restricted and not be so painful, and that they can find inclusion, acceptance, integration, and courage and hope and acceptance, in the places that they go. So those are the themes of the Posada, as people sing En nombre del cielo, as the pilgrims looking for asylum. And the innkeepers saying, no room. And what are the reasons that people have no room these days? Affordable housing, impossible. Immigration status, been impossible to find common ground and work something out. The oppression of women, the oppression of people because of their skin color and skin tone. And the exclusion of people who are poor and from sectors of our society that we don't appreciate. So that's been the theme leading up to this great Christmas, day. So not just some sort of little romantic story about the baby Jesus, but a real life story of people's struggle on the road, and that we're all a pilgrim people, whether we wish to recognize it or not. So it's been a great time of spiritual growth, I hope, and beating back the powers of greed and economic systems and political systems that exclude rather than include. Big, long, fat answer to that question.
Well, much appreciated. And as you just mentioned, the broader issues of economic justice and in this country, and in many ways, more and more of us are living in the manger and fewer of us are living in the inn.
Right.
And that is the reality of America today. We're becoming almost a feudal country in terms of the distribution of wealth, the collapse of the middle class, and the impoverishment. I mean, there's so many people. Walmart employees don't get a living wage. The fast food workers don't get a living wage. Even bank tellers don't get a living wage.
Right, absolutely.
So what's happening to our country?
Well, I think we're slipping or maybe running to more and more, a huge gap, the wage gap and the wealth gap between, the bottom sector and the top sector. And, I think for people on the top, just the amount of benefits and perks and salary and bonuses that go to the people at the top, it's just obscene when, in our community is being held together by low-wage workers who are trying to cobble together two or three jobs in order to survive. Here in this community, we have people who work in the fields all day. Then at night, they clean office buildings do maintenance and cleaning work in the hotel, motel, sector and try to pick up a construction job here or there. Or any sort of combination of those, those things. And, they were hit really bad by the economic downturn. If they're your lawn guy, the people who clean your house and do odd jobs and, you just call them less, have them come fewer times. And so the number of people who are underemployed, who are just working very hard but unable to to work in any kind of stable, employment. It seems to me that we could do a lot better job in creating systems and situations where there is work for people and it's a stable work and it's a decent, living wage. But we start talking about that stuff. In this supposedly generous moment of of Christmas, people are thinking about, oh, what family can I adopt? Well, do you even know a family, that you could adopt? We have people call here all the time. They want to adopt a family. It's a feel-good thing that they could give, this family's children presents on Christmas. Meanwhile, the shamed and dejected father and mother are sitting in the next room, unable to provide, any kind of, sort of material surprises, for their children. It's I think our idea also of charity and and helping can just perpetuate the system rather than challenge it. Why don't people give at Christmas time to to social change organizations that are trying to look at some of the root causes of the economic disparities and the political stuckness of our society? But no, we want to do the feel good thing. Do a soup kitchen line. I'm not demeaning those things, but they aren't changing things. Mm-hmm. They're helping keep the people at the bottom alive. And while we need to do that, we need to also be planning how we're going to put ourselves out of business because our services in that way are not needed any longer.
So in terms of the materialism that you mentioned that associates with Christmas and certainly precedes it with all the shopping mania and gift giving, et cetera, and the shame of parents that don't have the money, and of course young children and children in general in this country are bombarded with advertising that creates these demands. And it's kind of cruel that we have a younger generation now who are heavily indentured with student debt.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, we've created this generation of sophisticated consumers, but they don't have the purchasing power. So they're caught in this kind of no man's land. What's your sense of in terms of religion, Sister Ann Kendrick, of what, we got the one hand, you've got the prosperity gospel on the one hand, and then you've got the real gospel on the other, and you've got the God of love and so much of the religion of hate, with awful bigotry coming from so-called Christians on television who are now, a lot of prominent people like Sarah Palin are defending this character, the patriarch of the Duck Dynasty, which is a TV reality show, who made some very, very unpleasant and nasty racist remarks and yet he wraps himself in Christianity, and so do his defenders. So, you know, if you were an alien visiting from Mars, you would wonder what, whose God are we talking about here?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I think that, that we've just, commercialized and made, the God of capitalism, the Christian God, and I think people didn't really read the book. And the book isn't just static. The book continues to be, that revelation of, God continues to be explored and, as in our growing, sort of global cosmic consciousness. I mean, I think that those of us that really want to be on a true spiritual path, not on just a protectionism and, ooh, how can I catapult myself into the, into the afterlife, which sounds so unappealing to me. We run the Jesus who came to die for our sins. Well, how about the life part first? Let's talk about the beauty of life and the beauty of creation and the beauty of for those of us that are Christian that believe in, a God that loved us so that became one of us, not just to suffer and die, but to live, to live, to teach us how to live, how to be inclusive, how to be, how a spirituality of subtraction, it's of diminishment, and that was actually God's process, was one of emptying of oneself to become so identified and connected to the other. I think those parts of our spirituality just don't get talked about too much because they're very threatening to, to just personal prosperity and, getting all of your stuff that you want and that you need. And it's, even those of us who want to live in a different way, in a simpler way, it is so hard in the middle of all of this. And then you work with people who are impoverished and who are already so seduced into, happiness comes from those things, and I can sit in a place of arrogance because I have a choice. I have a choice. And, people who are poor, they're into forced diminishment, but there is a place in that, that does touch the heart of, since they can't count on anything else, but I'm not saying that that's the motivation, that they still believe in a gracious God, a loving God, a God of goodness, and a God of abundance, and their generosity is amazing. People who have, in the material world, next to nothing, roll over and take in a family that's unknown to them. Come to get some toys for Christmas. We do an alternative thing. We take new toys and, part of me hates it, but part of me, thinks it is at least a part of a solution to this Christmas mania. And we make our own Christmas store, and for 10 cents on the dollar, poor people can come and buy what they want for their kids and hide them and give it as if it was Santa or the baby Jesus or mom and dad or, whatever their tradition or culture, is, but it's controlled by them. And they can come and they can spend $25 or $50 and buy things that are worth 10 times that and bring them home and be able to give them, to their own, their own loved ones. And, that's sort of a compromise. The other part of me wants to not even get involved in it at all. But we don't have toys that are violent. We don't have toys that are damaging or that are competitive. We try to have educational things and clothes and things that are useful and that are pretty and that are beautiful and are inspiring and can teach love and compassion and skills to young, and to young children. So that's our little effort to try to do something different and still respond to the bazillion people that, in the days before Christmas want to give us stuff and want to adopt a family. So contribute to our Christmas store, and we raise a little money to help us keep on the lights in January and February and do the alternative things that we try to do, and we allow, you know, we had 500 families that could shop at the store, and for many of them, it was the one thing that they could do in order to have some presents for because they're working poor people that don't qualify for the giveaway things, you know, and they're people who don't get in those lines anyway because they don't think that they're poor, that they're that they're that needy, and they're the hardworking working poor people who we try to help through that. But it's just, it was Thanksgiving, we were giving thanks, sort of, and then it was Christmas, and the whole, I think one of the beautiful parts of the Christian tradition is Advent, the waiting, the longing. In the middle of that comes the solstice, the longest night of the year, where we honor the darkness and the creativity, the gestation, the beautiful things. And how darkness, the dark shadow parts of our lives, can bring us such gifts if we don't just run away from them or pretend that they're not part of who we are or what our life history is. They bring us learning. Somehow we seem to learn more from the sort of the crises, oops, oh my God, what am I going to do moments, the help me God moments. So I'm sad that Christmas, Thanksgiving Day, all the lights are up for Christmas, and we don't get to really feel the longing, the darkness, the journey, the call for patience and belief that, this is not an instant transformation. This journey of spiritual life with God isn't a quick fix, or it isn't just a fix to our panic or to our fear. It's a life process of believing in the sacred, of the goodness of creation, caring for the earth, growing in our cosmic, consciousness of how we are all part of the whole. Boy, if we could really spend some time thinking about that instead of running to Walmart, to get a cheap deal.
Well, also think of the people that work at Walmart.
Absolutely.
That are surrounded by all that materialism. Right. And yet they can't even afford those toys for their own kids.
That's right.
I mean, that's where, right, I think. And when you consider that the Walton family, the heirs to the founder of Walmart's fortune, the combined wealth of the children of Sam Walton are the equivalent of the entire wealth of the lower 40% of all Americans.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Oh, it's unbelievable. But I mean, it's absolutely factual that the combined wealth of the seven heirs are the equivalent of the
combined wealth.
Right, of the lower 40% of all Americans.
Wow.
Which is what would that
be? Oh, that makes it just more horrible, more heinous. Oh, my God.
Right. And that's, what, about 120-plus million Americans we're talking about there?
Right. Right.
So,
well, I think I used to think, that we were going to have this big revolutionary moment, and that I might see the edge of it. And I think more now it's, you dig down into a local community and you work in a practical way with people toward integration, toward diversity, toward building the community. We do a lot of service learning, immersion stuff with college students. And bringing them into our community. They live with migrant farm worker families, and they work in the fields, and they live with undocumented immigrant families, and which kind of blows the face of these undocumented immigrants who are criminals, and it upsets their worldview and their whatever stereotypical information that they had before they, before they came. But it's also, it has a mutual effect, because as they live with families and gain, some respect and see the dignity and the resilience and the beauty of these families, it becomes a mutually empowering thing, where the families with whom they stay and the young people that are part of our youth, program that talk to them about their life and their issues, they are also, they grow in self-esteem by feeling the respect and the honor that they feel from these, sort of outsiders, white people or, people that aren't part of their normal, social construct, who are awed by the gifts, the graciousness, the hospitality, and the hard work, and the humility of this community. And the local families feel it. And so the kids and the students who come from other places also have a transformative experience, and it becomes a mutually empowering and a mutually healing thing. And so maybe the change that we're looking for is going to be like the 100th monkey, you know, with if we just everybody in our own little pockets, you on the West Coast, us on the East Coast, all kind of digging in different parts of the community, but working toward consciousness and goodness and receptivity and inclusion and working toward restoring right relationship in the broken community where everybody belongs. Everybody belongs. Someday that's going to be, just in the air, you know, and enough of it in the air that we can look around and say, well, maybe we won't be still alive to look around and say, oh, my God, you know, the tipping point has arrived, and it's tipped back in the other direction. It's tipped in a way toward the direction of goodness and wholeness and inclusion. You know, maybe, you know, in the Buddhist view, right, it's 700 years is a good plan, you know.
Well, you know, when you talk, Sister Anne, of revolutionary times, there appears to be, at least some people think there's a revolution going on within your church, the Catholic Church.
Well, that'd be good. Boy, we could use it.
Well, do you think that this new leader, this new Pope, Pope Francis, I know on the one hand he's adamantly saying he's not going to ordain women, which is, I think, a prerequisite to make the church healthy again. On the other hand, he is saying stuff and doing stuff that indicates a different direction towards the very prophet that the church is based on.
Right. No, I think it's a breath of fresh air. I'm very, on one hand, very sort of encouraged, inspired by his direction. I think he is a humble person whose life has been touched by people in poverty and by systems that oppress. He gets that, that it's not only personal piety, but it's social change and it's working for the community and it's simple things. It's not just doctrinal, enforcement. I think the danger is a little bit, when you have, an inspiring and benevolent leader, and the system is still very patriarchal and very hierarchical and not so guided by community energy and community input and community and believing really that the spirit, lives in the community of believers, not just ordained clerics. That we can back off from the need for structural change, the need for institutional change. So that's a little worry that I have. Oh God, everybody likes Pope Francis. Ooh, so we don't have to look at. Well, not everybody likes him, but those of us that believe that that we need some radical change, radical in the best sense of the word, that it's root, it's back to our roots. Jesus was a radical. He wasn't just. It isn't just some little romantic story that he came to jump to the cross. It was his lifestyle and his commitment to poor people and to simplicity and to belief in the spirit and in the communion of believers, upset the apple cart of all the people in power in his time. And that's what, I'm preaching to you, you already know that, that's what brought him to his death. He didn't just come to jump to that. It was his life that exacted that sacrifice. And so I think we miss that part. We jump right to the, oh, Jesus died for our sins. Somebody told me that they were working in a homeless shelter with a unchurched, lucky for her, woman. And I think it was a Catholic nun who was saying, God sent his only son to die for us, to save us and for our sins. And the woman said, oh my God, the God that you believe in is a child abuser? an unloving father who would exact, death and murder of his only son? what kind of a God is that? Is that? It's, you know, that does kind of, you know, set, you know, kind of stop you up short, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
So anyway, so much to think about and talk about in this time of Christmas. So we're talking about God becoming one of us. Wow, that's, I think that's a pretty amazing miracle.
Well, but you also, within your church, you have the both of those strains that you just discussed, the
right.
idea of humility and ministering to the least among us on the one hand, and then the power structure on the other.
Right.
And so do you think that the cardinals who elected this pope are having buyer's remorse?
They might, you know, but, you know, maybe, you know, I was kind of down on really believing that the Spirit worked among them, but somehow, you know, he was the guy that was chosen, you know, so, you know, it's restored my faith in, you know, that even in those sectors, the Holy Spirit can be alive and well, and, you know, maybe people, maybe they did know, you know, kind of what they were getting, you know, and maybe... You know, maybe they didn't, you know, but I think people of true integrity, I mean, I know in the story, they say of Bishop Romero, when he was, you know, selected to be the bishop in El Salvador, it was because he'd hold the place together. It was because of his conservatism and his orthodoxy. And that is indeed where he started out. But as he, you know, as he was working with these young priests who were being assassinated, because of their commitment with the poor, and went to those villages and saw, you know, the selfless, you know, commitment of these young priests to the campesino people, to the peasant people, and to their struggle simply to live, that it wasn't an ideological, you know, debate, you know, in a classroom about what, you know, economic system do you want. It was, how can these people live? How can they survive with the oppression from the government and with, you know, and with systems, you know, of all types that oppress them? And his openness to that experience moved him along a continuum to where he preached, you know, against the government and against the authority of the government to order other peasant military people to shoot and kill their neighbors, and wow, that was a big shift for him. Mm-hmm. But it was a shift that happened in increments because of his life experience, and I think because he was a holy man who really was open to listening to God's call, to God's, you know, to what was God saying and doing here, and how, you know, could he understand that, and how could he be a leader of faith in that place? And so, you know, maybe that's what's going to happen with Francis, and who he says now, maybe he's not going to make any, you know, major doctrinal, you know, changes, but, you know, who knows where, you know, his life experience as a pastor dealing with people, and especially, you know, in the case of the women, you know, their total feeling of, you know, rejection and alienation and oppression, you know, even though, you know, they're the worker bees. They're the worker bees and the collegial problem solvers in a lot of places. You know, bring them in, and somehow the power shifts from who's, you know, the winners and losers to how can we collaborate together, and how can we, you know, move forward in a place, you know, where everybody has a place to stand.
Well, Sister Anne, I thank you so much for joining us on
this. No, I'm happy to, always happy to talk to you, even though it's once a year.
Well, it's an august and wonderful day, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, you take care. Thank you,
you too.
So much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sister Anne Kendrick, who's one of the co-founders of the Hope Community Center in Apopka, Florida, in 1971. Sister Anne and three other members of the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur moved to the area bordering Orlando and founded what was originally called the Office of Farm Worker Ministry. Since then, Sister Anne and her partners have been working to address the problems confronting migrant laborers in Central Florida. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.